News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Today is Monday, June 18th. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to the campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5.05 p.m. and time for another almost full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We also have your weekly health segment by Sharon Hundle, as well as a chat with Maddie Kipling from Car Free Vancouver, and Paul Runes from Voices in the Park, and Adrienne Montani from First Call BC Child and Youth Advocacy Coalition about the child poverty rate in BC.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. Now for your local headlines.
An increase in students asking for replacement passes this summer has prompted UBC's Transportation and Planning Office to put in new, tighter guidelines for students who ask for a second monthly U-Pass. While students will still be able to replace a lost pass for $35, a replacement policy means that they can't get a second monthly pass within 24 hours of being issued their first one. The policy also puts a significant cap on the total number of replacement passes that can be distributed in one day. UBC has not confirmed the number of passes in the daily cap. These new restrictions will not apply to anyone who is able to provide a valid police report number concerning a lost or stolen U-Pass. UBC's contract with TransLink limits the total number of second U-Passes that a university can give out each month, and this number was exceeded for May passes on May 22nd. Apparently, UBC has not yet exceeded its June quota, though it came dangerously close to doing so.
Two pioneering UBC researchers who developed the, quote, ecological footprint concept have won the Blue Planet Award for Sustainability, which is one of the world's premier environmental prizes, valued at nearly $645,000 at the Rio Plus 20 United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development in Brazil. The award was given to Dr. William Rees, a professor emeritus at the UBC School of Community and Regional Planning, and Rees's former doctoral student, Mathis Wackernagel, for advancing the global conversation around human carrying capacity, ecological economics, and environmental policy. The ecological footprint was developed by Rees and Wackernagel in the early 1990s, and it is an accounting system for estimating national, regional, or individual demand on the biosphere and can document human consumption relative to the biosphere's regenerative capacity. Using the ecological footprint as a measure, Dr. Rees suggests that humanity already exists in a state of severe ecological overshoot. They estimated that if every person uses as many resources as the average North American, more than four Earths would be required to sustain the total rate of consumption, depletion, and waste assimilation. Established in 1992 by Japan's Asahi Glass Foundation, the Blue Planet Award recognizes research achievements that have helped provide solutions to global environmental problems. This year, 98 nominees from 24 countries were nominated, and three, Rees, Wackernagel, and U.S. ecologist Thomas Lovejoy, have received the distinction.
Two labor groups are taking to the BC Supreme Court to challenge a controversial bill that bans union executives from serving on the boards of post-secondary institutions. The Federation of Post-Secondary Educators, or the FPSE, and the BC Government and Service Employees Union, BCGEU, filed notice Monday that they were challenging legislation that bans faculty from sitting on a university or college board of governors while serving on the executive of a union. They argue that the legislation, known as Bill 18, undermines union members' charter rights. Philip Legg, communications director for the FPSC, said that, quote, Bill 18 says you have to choose between whether you are going to be active in your union or on the board of your institution. You shouldn't have to make that choice. Being active in your union is a right that you have. It's called the freedom of association, end quote. Bill 18 was tabled in November 2011 by Minister of Advanced Culture Naomi Yamamoto. The challenge was brought after the legislation was used to remove a union-affiliated faculty member from the Vancouver Island University Board. Yamamoto argued that allowing union executives to serve on post-secondary boards is a conflict of interest. But according to UBC Board of Governors faculty representative Nassif Gossoub, the province is sending universities a mixed message on what constitutes a conflict of interest. He said that if the province is going to start declaring conflicts of interest for union executives, they should also examine whether a conflict exists for those in management positions as well.
After a year-long search, the University of British Columbia has announced that Professor Robert Helsley will return to the Sauder School of Business as its new dean on July 1st. Helsley, currently at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, will replace Sauder's outgoing dean, Daniel Muzica, who steps down on June 30th after 13 years of service. A senior associate dean at Sauder from 2002 to 2008, Professor Helsley also served as the director of the UBC Center for Real Estate and Urban Economics and as chair of the Urban Land Economics Division. At the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley since 2008, Helsley served as a professor and chair in real estate development and was the co-chair of the Fisher Center for Real Estate and Urban Economics. Professor Helsley was selected as dean after an intensive UBC recruitment process, including consultations with faculty, staff, students, and members of Sauder's Faculty Advisory Board.
And now we go to an interview with Paul Runis by our CITR reporter Nina Kirgia, discussing Voices in the Park, which is a fundraising concert benefiting the Sarah McLachlan School of Music, taking place on September 15th this year. It will be put on by McLachlan. So Nina talked to Paul Runis, who's executive producer, earlier today about the fundraiser.
Hello, Paul. So we just wanted to ask you a little bit about what the event is and how it started.
Okay. Well, it's a fundraising concert to benefit Sarah School of Music. So it's technically, I guess this is the second one we've done. We did one in 2009 in Ambleside Park in West Vancouver with Neil Young and Sheryl Crow and others, which benefited the school back then. And so this is version 2.0. We've moved across the water to a bigger site, and really excited about what we're in for here.
So what are some of the headlining bands that will be there?
So far, we're able to announce, obviously, Sarah, Jan Arden, Headley, my mind's going completely blank here for some reason.
I think Stevie Nicks will
thank
be
you.
There. Yeah.
As well as Chin and Jetty, who is the Grammy Award-winning producer. He used to be in a band called Bass is Bass, but is now working with Eminem and Pink and people like that.
Okay.
And the Boom Booms, also the Vancouver Men's Chorus will be there. And there are a couple of others that we'll be announcing in the coming weeks.
And do you guys have an expected sort of audience already? Are you expecting...
In terms of numbers?
In terms of numbers, yeah, because your event was a lot smaller.
The event in Ambleside was 9,000. We sold it out in the first day. I mean, we'd love to think we'll sell this out. It's anyone's guess at this point. I mean, certainly we're hoping for good weather and a great turnout, but I think we'll need to get up on sale and see how things track.
Yeah, so can you tell me a little bit about Sarah's School of Music?
So her school, which is now housed, they now have a permanent facility. They were, for a number of years, they were attached to Arts Umbrella and operated in shared space with them, but they've since moved into, about a year ago actually, moved into a permanent facility just off of Main and 7th, which was kindly donated by the Wolverton Foundation. So the basic premise of the school is it provides free after-school music programs for at-risk youth, at-risk and underserved youth in Vancouver, obviously. So So it's, you know, it's giving music, you know, education to people that otherwise wouldn't have the means to get it. So.
Okay, perfect. And this is for school age children. So
yeah, I think it's you can check on the website, but I believe it goes grades 4 to 12.
Okay. Okay. Well, how can people get tickets for this event?
Tickets pre-sale start tomorrow. The general public on sale is Friday morning at 10 a.m. And you can get tickets through the Ticketmaster website, or you can link through to it from the voicesinthepark.com website, which also has a ticket feature on it. So 10 a.m. Friday will be the general sales.
And the date is for this September 15th?
This September, Saturday, September 15th. Doors will open at 2 p.m. and the show begins around 4, and it'll continue right through until about 11 p.m.
Perfect. Thanks for talking with us. This is seems like
welcome.
A really, really event for a good cause.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's going to be a beautiful event. So.
Perfect.
Thank you to Nina for that segment. So we're going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us. We will be right back with your provincial and national news. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Anta Cecilia Point, Talitsinat Plaswa Musqueam. My name is Cecilia Point. I'm a member of the Musqueam First Nation. The Musqueam Nation is holding vigil at the corner of Southwest Marine and Hudson, and we're protecting our ancestral burial grounds, which have been approved for development. So if you'd like to come down and join us, we will be here 24 hours a day until we receive justice. You can bring food or coffee or bring flowers for our ancestors. If you'd like to donate food, call 604-649-5556. And otherwise, just come down and spend some time with us and hold up a sign and show your support. We'd really appreciate it. Thank you. Haichika.
2012 Grammy Award winners Tedeschi Trucks Band brings their blues-inspired show to the Vancouver Centre for Performing Arts for one night, June 19th. Tickets on sale at Ticketmaster.ca or by calling 855-985-5000. Don't miss Tedeschi Trucks Band on June 19th at the Vancouver Centre for Performing Arts. For more information, go to TedeschiTrucks.com.
Well, I came to the city. I was running from...
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle. I'm with CJ, and it is now time for our interview with Adrienne Montani, who is the First Call Provincial Coordinator for BC. First Call is a BC Child and Youth Advocacy Coalition, and we're talking to her today about the poverty rate for children here in British Columbia. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So first of all, I know we found out today that the child poverty rate in BC dropped from 11.8% in 2009 to 10.5% in 2010.
That's right.
But that doesn't seem to still be the best news. And can you tell us why?
Well, yeah, that's because these are incremental changes from year to year, and we're still way, you know, the fact that we're above 10%, so 1 in 10 kids or more, the fact that it hasn't changed very much for the last 20 years or so, or 30 years, and that's a lot of kids, 87,000 children. And this is using a fairly conservative measure. There's different poverty lines you can use or low-income cutoffs. This is the after-tax one. So it's actually even higher if you use it before tax. It's more like 14%.
Oh, wow.
So, but using the after-tax, because we get quibbling with government sometimes, they prefer the after-tax one.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when you're looking at wages and things like that, then you need to use the before tax.
Right.
Measure. Anyway, so the issue is really that each child who's poor or growing up struggling with poverty is not meeting their full potential. There's all kinds of issues like social exclusion, poor nutrition, substandard housing. All those things are very real in kids' lives. And it costs us. It costs them and it costs us.
And we know that for the last 8 years, the child poverty rate in BC has actually been the worst in Canada.
That's right.
And right now, I think we dropped, was it to second worst?
Second worst.
Okay. So.
And we've been above the national average, so worse than the Canadian average for since 1999.
Wow. Okay.
So yes, we're Manitoba has the worst this year on this measure, but we're right behind them.
So what kind of actions has the government taken thus far, I guess, but, well, more specifically between 2009 and 2010, that might have helped us to see that drop, however incremental it might have been?
Well, we don't think there's been much action on the part of government, to tell you the truth, because there, even good things that have happened in recent years, like the raising of the minimum wage, which is something we advocate for, we're glad that went up. But really, for families, that doesn't, that's not enough money. Even so, if you're a single parent, for instance, working full-time, full year on minimum wage, even at the new rate, you wouldn't be making enough to bring yourself above the poverty line.
Mm-hmm.
So while we're happy to see those things, we don't think it's really affected family poverty. We think the reason it's probably coming down a bit is just people are working harder and more.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people are working two jobs if they need to try and make ends meet.
So what kind of measures would you like to see the current government or the opposition implement in order to make an investment to fight poverty?
Well, the first thing is to have a plan, and that's what the current government seems to have resisted, in having a universal cross-government plan, because poverty is complex and people are poor for different reasons sometimes. Mm-hmm. You need to look at a range of things. So we'd like to see a plan in place, as other provinces have done, to mm-hmm. Have a plan. A legislated plan would be our preference, because mm-hmm. then it ties it. Whoever gets elected, they'd have to change the legislation, but hopefully they wouldn't, and we'd be tied to these specific legislative targets that would say we're going to bring it down by this much, and therefore we have to be accountable for that.
Mm-hmm.
And what we'd like to see in a plan like that is a universal publicly funded child care system, so parents don't end up paying like a second mortgage or not being able to work because they either can't find a quality space or can't afford it. Mm-hmm. That would be a big one, and it would really reduce this. A lot of research that would show that a child care system like they have in Quebec would actually lower the poverty rate, especially if it was provided free to low-income families, mm-hmm. and then at a modest cost for those who can afford it. But we look at $10 a day as a reasonable cost. Mm-hmm. For those who are the poorest of the poor, we'd like to see income assistance rates or welfare rates mm-hmm. increased rather dramatically, because they're just substandard for even subsistence right now, and certainly for proper nutrition and housing. And we'd like to see, because most poor kids live in families whose parents are working, either part-time or full-time,
mm-hmm.
or part-year, we'd like to see people pay decent wages. So we have a campaign called the Living Wage for Families campaign, where we try and encourage especially large employers, which would include government and all of their contractors, and also large private sector employers, to pay a living wage that we calculate every year that looks at what the actual costs of living are. And it's not a fancy wage, it's below the median wage, but mm-hmm. it would at least bring people out so they weren't in crisis all the time or chronic stress.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned a bit about the child welfare system such as they have in Quebec, but I know that the Premier has made the commitment to like the zero net increase, and so do you think that it's likely to see this government putting anything in action or any plans? Or
well, all they've done is put in place they have seven communities that are going to pilot very small poverty reduction initiatives working with local municipalities, but they've been very clear that there's no new money for that, so there mm-hmm. and that there's no policy change anticipated between now and the next provincial election. So this government's been pretty clear there's not going to be any big investments, mm-hmm. there's not going to be any increases in ministries that serve children, like Ministry for Children Family Development, and these projects, while they may do some interesting community development, they're not going to be able to change things like welfare rates, access to child care, those kinds of things that would mm-hmm. make a difference. And so we're, you know, happy to support those things, but don't think they're really the answer. Some of the bigger policy issues need to be addressed, and the big investments like a child care system.
Definitely. Just one more question. I know that you've been mentioning this program, and you did mention Quebec, as I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a model that you'd like to see being built in BC, or is that just sort of one alternative that exists right now and you'd want to be going down a different route?
Well, it's the principle of a universal entitlement that all children should have access to quality child care at a reasonable cost that's funded by public funds is the same one we want to see in BC, but there is a made in BC child care plan
mm-hmm.
that is the Child Care Advocates, one of our coalition partners, and Early Childhood Educators of BC, another one of our coalition partners, have put together. A great deal of research is behind it, and they've gone out and they're gathering support around the province and have presented it to government. So that's what we'd like to take that work that's been done by the experts in the community and look at putting it into legislation, an Early Childhood Act that would then mandate actually school boards to expand their mandates to take on child care. That's what we'd like to see, because that's what the research shows is it's the trend worldwide and provides the most stable and institutional environment that would be able to handle the expansion of child care system, but make sure that it's, of course, child-friendly and not a school program, but an early childhood play-based program.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Mm-hmm. What can listeners do if they want to get more involved in this?
Well, they can... we'll be releasing a child poverty report card with more statistics. Today was just the initial ones that come out in November, so they can watch for that on First Call's website, and it's www.firstcallbc.org. But in the meantime, I think because we do have a provincial election coming up, they can start letting know both political parties know what they want to see in their platforms. This is that child poverty is a nonpartisan issue. We expect action from whoever gets elected, and that this is an issue that they might that would affect how they vote. Let people know it's a real priority for them. That would be extremely helpful.
Awesome. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Sure. Thank you for your interest.
Okay. Take care.
Right, bye.
Bye-bye. So once again, that was Adrienne Montani from First Call BC. It's a BC Child Youth and Advocacy Coalition. So if you want any more interest or any more information on the dropping poverty rate for children in BC and what more action can be taken, you can visit firstcallbc.org. So now it is time for your provincial and national headlines.
Just over a month after the BC Public School Employers Association asked the BC Labor Relations Board, the LRB, to put an end to the teachers' extracurricular strike, the LRB has given a little something to both sides. In a ruling issued late Friday morning, the Labor Relations Board Vice Chair Ritu Mahil declared the teachers' refusal to perform extracurricular activities is within their rights for activities not related to courses or undertaken for marks. These include coaching, school graduation ceremonies, and supervising student performances, sports team activities, field trips, or clubs. In a press release issued by the BC Teachers Federation President Susan Lambert, she declared the ruling a, quote, significant legal victory, end quote. But the ruling did find the BC Teachers Federation has been remiss in directing or authorizing teachers from withdrawing from work activities that fall outside of regular classroom time, like parent-teacher meetings and individual education plan meetings, as well as Ministry of Education initiatives like kindergarten orientation.
A legal opinion prepared for Parliament's budget watchdog says 64 federal government departments and agencies are breaking the law by not handing over basic information about $5.2 billion in budget cuts. Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page has been skirmishing with the federal bureaucracy since the March budget, arguing he needs to have certain details about the planned cuts in order to do his job. He says only 18 of 82 federal organizations have complied with his request for more details about the fiscal impact of cuts stemming from the 2012 budget. A review led by constitutional lawyer Joseph Magnet from the University of Ottawa concluded that 64 departments were not in compliance with the Act because they have not handed over the requested information. In the legal opinion released this morning, lawyers said the Act requires the federal government to release financial and economic data in a timely manner. The federal government argues that it can't release details about the cuts because of collective agreements.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights is criticizing Quebec's Bill 78, a new law that imposes strict limits on student protests. Navi Pillay spoke out about the special law in her opening address at the Human Rights Council in Geneva, Switzerland, on Monday morning. In the speech, Pillay also touched on many human rights hotspots around the world, including Syria, Mali, Nepal, Mexico, and Russia. However, another UN watchdog group called UN Watch issued a statement... a UN watchdog group called UN Watch issued a statement calling the reference to Quebec absurd. It pointed out that Bill 78 was passed by a democratically elected government and that opponents have the opportunity to challenge it in court. Student federations in Quebec have filed a legal motion to temporarily suspend the special law until July, when a court is expected to hear the group's second legal challenge to seeking to declare the law invalid. Bill 78, which was passed into law on May 18th, was the Quebec government's legal response to a student crisis sparked 3 months ago over planned tuition increases.
And those were your provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but please do stay tuned for your international news as well as your local weather forecast for the week. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Cinco Cinco Wednesdays at the Cobalt. $5 cover, $5 draft, and $5 highballs. A weekly showcase of up-and-coming bands, artists, and DJs, where the artists get 100% of their ticket sales. For more information, visit thecobalt.ca.
You can ride with us, man, but you're riding in the back because I got a shot.
The Rio Theater is your independent East Vancouver theater, playing first-run feature films, independent film screenings, as well as live events. Every Friday night, there are featured midnight cult classics on the big screen, and no one can beat The Rio for their cheap date Tuesdays.
There's no better place to be than The Rio for classic movies like The Big Lebowski, The Room, Carrie, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Dazed and Confused, and Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill. Special events at The Rio this month include June 15th. Bring your dancing shoes for Good with Grapes with Young Pacific and Daraval. Tickets are $10. Doors open at 10 p.m. Starting June 21st to July 1st, come watch the Euro 2012 finals starting at 11 a.m. And on the last Wednesday of the month, come get your nerd on with the hit show Dungeons & Dragons. Join Vancouver's best comedians as they quest for glory and honor in this live improvised performance.
For more information on all this and more, check out theriotheater.ca.
You're all shook up, aren't you, baby?
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle, and unfortunately our usual weatherman, Phil Chang, couldn't be with us today, but we are joined with our guest weatherman, Carl Dawson. So, Carl, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Claire. Tonight's going to be partly cloudy, becoming cloudy later this evening, low of 11. Tuesday's going to be cloudy with a mix of sun and clouds in the morning, high of 18, low of 7. Tuesday night's going to be partly cloudy. Wednesday is sunny with a high of 19 and a low of 11. Thursday's going to be a mix of sun and clouds with a high of 20 and a low of 12. Friday, again, is a mix of sun and clouds with a high of 22 and a low of 14. That's the weather for CITR.
Awesome. Thanks, Carl. Looks like a better week than we had this past week, which is nice. So now we go to our regular health segment, Dietitian Intuition, with contributor Sharon Hundle. So I guess she interviewed someone, an expert on celiac disease, at a conference this past week, so we look forward to hearing what she had to say to us.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Dietetics Intuition, your source for precise nutrition advice. Today's segment is a special feature on the annual National Dietetics Dietitians of Canada Conference held in Toronto this past week. The whole crew went and we met with leading experts in food and nutrition. We have an introduction to what the conference is all about with Kristen Yorker, as well as new info regarding celiac disease and the gluten-free diet with Shelley Case, and then practical tips for cooking with lentils with Gloria Zhang of healthcastle.com. So let's roll the clips.
I'm with Kristen Yorker, the BC Executive Regional Director for, obviously, British Columbia. We're discussing the Dietitians of Canada Conference, and what are the stats? How many dietitians came here to Toronto, Kristen?
It's been a fantastic conference, our largest ever, with over 1,000 dietitians from across Canada all gathered here in Toronto this past week for a variety of sessions, really celebrating the great breadth of our profession. One thing that people often don't know of is where dietitians work, and that just keeps expanding where dietitians are working. There's such a great entrepreneurial spirit amongst dietitians and a real pioneering spirit where they're just reaching out and finding fantastic new ways to be working all throughout Canada and all throughout our communities and hospitals and everywhere that people interact with food and healthcare system. Dietitians are working now, and that's been what's a great theme that's been running through our session is the great new ways that people are breaking out, in whether it's embracing social media. There was a fantastic session on dietitians and cinema, which is a fantastic way of reaching out there and reaching more of the public with our messages. There are dietitians publishing their own books. There are dietitians working on different healthcare teams in different parts of the healthcare system. There are dietitians opening their own businesses. I was meeting with one dietitian who owns a spa. There are dietitians working with the government in different ways. There are dietitians working on the phone lines now. Those were being highlighted. And what was really, I'm just energized with right now, is the idea of hope and excitement for the future amongst our profession. We have been expanding the number of students and interns slowly, and the new energy that folks are coming with is fantastic. We had a huge delegation of dietetic students, dietetic interns, and brand new dietitians at this conference. And the energy and the vision and the enthusiasm that these folks have been bringing to the conference, and the ideas and thinking outside the box and questioning why do things have to be the same as they have been in the past, has been just so inspirational, and it's been a fantastic theme throughout the conference.
Excellent. And anything that you think our listeners should be excitedly watching out for in terms of nutrition in the news, and anything that this conference, do you think, has sparked in the hearts of dietitians looking to do some research, or people like us who are looking to report on dietetic research?
I think you're just going to see dietitians out and about communicating with the public in more and more ways. One of the fantastic things about social media is that it really is so much more accessible for people now. Back in the day when you had to be like a big TV star, or you had to spend millions of dollars on a Super Bowl ad to get your message across, as a small profession, we just couldn't do that. Where now, with social media and with all the amazing new technologies, our messages are out there in more and more ways. And I love seeing how dietitians and dietetic students and dietetic interns are embracing these and just putting themselves out there. I love seeing everybody on Twitter. I love seeing the YouTube videos. I love seeing on this radio station and the radio stations that are across Canada and the campuses and everywhere. It's just so fantastic to see everybody stepping up, getting our message out there.
Next, I have a short clip with Shelley Case, leading expert in celiac disease, and she has a website, glutenfreediet.ca.
So, hi, I'm here with Shelley Case, leading expert in celiac disease and gluten-free diet. So, hi, Shelley.
Nice to meet you, Sean.
Thank you. So, I understand there's going to be a presentation later on in the conference about this topic. Do you know anything about what is the latest messages around celiac disease and gluten-free?
What I'm going to talk about tomorrow in my two-hour session to dietitians is to help them understand that celiac disease is far more common than we thought. It affects about 1 in 100 people, but we estimate that only about 5 to 10% of people are actually diagnosed, means a lot of other people are walking around with things that they've been told they have: irritable bowel, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, it's all in your head, and they're desperately trying to figure out what's wrong with them when it may in fact be celiac. The other thing I'm going to talk about is some new research that is showing that it's possible to be sensitive to gluten and not have celiac disease, and we're calling this condition non-celiac gluten sensitivity, and we think it might affect up to 6% of the population. So if you combine the 1% with the 6%, the two together needing a gluten-free diet, that's a lot of Canadians, over 2 million Canadians, that would need to be following a gluten-free diet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I did notice there are some food products available here that are new. What are some of the top gluten-free products that you would recommend?
Well, there's lots. I mean, I have over 3,100 products in my book under the different categories of gluten-free products, and I taste a lot of different gluten-free foods, and I would say that the quality of gluten-free products has improved dramatically. It used to be pretty limited of what you could get, and it was very questionable at best as how good it was. For example, there's a company here, Silver Hill Country, from BC.
Oh, yeah.
And very excellent bread. It tastes good. It toasts up nicely, and it's whole grain, which is nice because a lot of the gluten-free products are made with refined flours and starches.
Right.
Canadian Excuse in Edmonton is another Canadian company that's just brought out a new soft multi-grain bread that's been enriched with iron and B vitamins. So there's a lot of Kellogg's, of course, is here with their gluten-free brown rice krispies. So that means that's an important thing, because for so long people had to go to a health food store to buy their gluten-free products. But now we're starting to see more of the mainstream grocery stores carrying that, and that's good news because these product price points are starting to come down because gluten-free products can be 2 to 3 times more expensive than the regular. So when that means when a family can go to the grocery store and buy off the shelf like everybody else, that's kind of neat, you know. And then General Mills, of course, has the Chex cereals, and now I see they're even selling them in single serve, so people in the hospital or nursing homes would be able to get a gluten-free cereal that, you know, isn't contaminated because it's single serve. So a really interesting phenomenon going on, a lot more gluten-free and more options. So that's good news. And as dietitians, we are the ones that people need to talk to because it's a complicated diet.
Yes.
And we need to help know what's safe, what's not safe, and then how to build a healthy gluten-free diet so they can stay healthy with their celiac disease or non-celiac gluten sensitivity.
Yeah, great. So I know a lot of people go on the internet for their research and stuff like that. What's the website that you would recommend for getting more information?
Well, I guess I would tell them to come to my website, which is www.glutenfreediet.ca. And what I've done on my website, I tried to make it a clearinghouse because there is so much misinformation out there about the gluten-free diet and a lot of people trying to sell you things and whatever. But what I want to do is have evidence-based information, but also practical information. So I have downloadable handouts and recipes and resources and things that people can get all things about celiac and gluten sensitivity and the gluten-free diet. So glutenfreediet.ca. And the other one is the Canadian Celiac Association, which is just celiac.ca. So those would be two really good websites to start with.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So I'm here with Rachel, and she's a representative from Canadian Lentils based in Saskatchewan.
Okay. So what is your involvement today with Dietitians of Canada? What are you doing?
So we work on behalf of the farmers in Canada who grow lentils. So we're growing and exporting 67% of the world's supply of lentils, but of all that we're growing, 99% is being exported. So it's going overseas. We really found that people in Canada, we need to start embracing what we grow and start eating more of it because it's such a health benefit to everyone. So we're here to work with the dietitians to promote how to get more lentils into consumer diet.
Okay, that sounds really great.
And so now I have a registered dietitian, Gloria Zhang, with healthcastle.com. So, Gloria, how can people use beans and lentils in their diet a little easier?
Anyone who can recognize this, that many people refer beans and lentils to meat substitute. And what I don't think is actually a meat substitute is when you think of meat substitute, it's those that I don't eat meat, then I'll eat those. But really, it is an everyday kind of food. You can incorporate some in lunch, dinner. And what you just have to do is be creative. And for example, with lentils, you could add it as a filler for a veggie burger. You could also add it in meat sauce in a pasta dish with wet sauce. You could also use it as just what I told you with the salsa. You could also make hummus with it. My favorite is actually red lentil hummus. So how you actually prepare it with normal hummus or regular hummus with chickpeas, you can actually use it with red lentils. So that's another way of adding colors to your plate and get the kids excited about eating healthy food.
Right. Okay. So now you did mention there are some drawbacks to using beans, such as fat and stuff like that. So do you have any tips, though, to get around that, or is it mostly to use lentils instead of beans?
I think they both are super nutritious powerhouse. With the beans, what you can do is actually soak it overnight and dispose of the water and then boil it with a new pot of water and boil it again. So that will, you know, get rid of the gas. With lentils, you don't need to do that. It's just a really easy 1, 2, 3 kind of step. And there are tons of recipes on the lentils website, lentils.ca. So I invite your listeners to go and check out all the recipes.
Okay. Thank you so much, Gloria, for your perspective on that.
All right, thanks for tuning in to this week's segment. We'll have the podcasted segment and website links available on our website, blogs.ubc.ca/dietetics intuition, following the segment. Don't forget to follow us at CITR Health on Twitter and like us on Facebook for the latest updates. Stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
Thank you to Sharon Handel for that health segment. We apologize for the low quality of the audio, but we will make sure that once we upload that audio to Mixcloud, it will be proper. All right, Claire? And now for our interview with
Maddie Kipling from Car Free Vancouver.
I just was hoping to maybe talk about, first of all, a bit about Car Free Vancouver, how it went, and what like the overall goals of it were, and then also just a bit about how the planning for it has changed in the last year, just given the Vancouver riots last year and what effect that had in your planning?
Okay, so you want to know how successful the festival, or how the festival went for us, and what were the changes in the planning between this year and last year?
Yeah, and then also, would there be any other areas that you think would be worth touching on?
Sure, maybe the fact that, I don't know, yeah, I guess we could chat about the fact that we're always looking to expand to new neighborhoods, and if people have any thoughts or comments or suggestions, that we'd love them to join our organizing crews.
Okay, awesome. So yeah, I can just touch on that in the end then. Okay, great. So I'll just turn on my recorder here. Okay, great. So Maddie, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, can you tell us a bit about Car Free Vancouver and what the goals are?
Well, I think our goals are numerous. One of our goals would be to take over a car-dominated street or public area, which is normally dominated by car traffic, and turning it into a public space where people can come together, much like a plaza or a piazza that you might find in Europe. So bringing people together in a space where you can nurture a community, where people can meet each other, their next-door neighbors, highlight local talents and culture.
Mm-hmm.
One of our other goals is to be 100% volunteer-driven. And one of the things that we do as Car Free Vancouver as a society is each neighborhood, we support people coming together to create a festival that reflects the arts and culture and business values and local family values of each neighborhood. So each neighborhood is really a reflection of the folks who live there, and it's all put on 100% voluntarily by people who put their time in, organize everything.
That sounds awesome.
Another goal I would say that we have is just getting, of course, cars off the street. We feel that Vancouver especially is such a small city. You can, get across it by transit or bike in, half an hour. So our current fossil fuel dependence needs to shift. So we're showing people that you can take over streets and use them positively, and just remind people to get out of their cars for the day.
And of course, for now, Car Free Vancouver, it's just the one day festival. But you did talk about taking over the public space and seeing it used as like a piazza or a square.
Mm-hmm.
And is that sort of a long-term goal that you'd hope to see expanded beyond just Car Free Vancouver Day as a festival?
Car Free Vancouver Society is the group who puts on Car Free Vancouver Day. We do use our festival as a platform or a place to start the discussion. We're working on longer term collective goals that will branch out into more areas throughout the year, whether that be supporting conferences, training workshops, supporting other organizations who have similar goals. The Vancouver Public Spaces Network is working on the Where's the Square, creating a public square in Vancouver. So those are all things that we support.
Okay, great. So the festival did happen this past weekend, so can you tell me some highlights from it?
Oh, my goodness. Highlights? Best music ever. I was blown away by the amazing musical talents that came out. I truly was. Vancouver is really blessed, and I hope everybody who came out to the festival realized how lucky they were. The music was amazing. We had stages everywhere, and the music was phenomenal. There was roller disco on Commercial Drive, particularly fantastic. I took a spin myself. I hadn't been on roller skates in a long time, but it was so fun. Street hockey, I absolutely love the street hockey on Main Street, to see little tiny kids who can barely hold a hockey stick playing against big burly adults, and everyone having the best time. The highlights were endless. It was amazing.
It sounds like a lot of fun, and of course it did coincide this year with Father's Day, and do you feel like that helped with the event and the attendance overall, or do you think that maybe detracted from it a bit?
I don't see it necessarily as a as an adding or a detract. I'd say that some of the feedback we've received from many people have been, thanks for having this on Father's Day. It's become an annual tradition for our family.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also heard from people, can't you have it on another day? I have to spend the day with my dad, but I really want to make it out. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's some people who absolutely love it being on Father's Day because it's now become an annual Father's Day event. And we have other people who feel like they've never been able to attend because it's Father's Day. I don't think we can necessarily please everybody if we have it on the same day, but at this moment, I feel like it works.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely have hundreds of thousands of people come out to the festival, so I think it's successful in that sense.
And looking at the festival in terms of logistics, of course, last year it happened pretty soon after the Stanley Cup riots here in Vancouver. And since then, of course, the government has passed some laws and some different regulations governing the use of public spaces and streets and so on. And how did that impact Carver Vancouver and your planning?
Well, for us, because we are 100% volunteer organized and operated, for us, we were doing all the planning outside of our regular work weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So normally it feels a little easier, a little smoother. This time around, we definitely had lots more paperwork to fill out. We had to work on safety plans to a greater extent than we have in the past. There would seem to be a lot more check boxes to be checked in order to have our festival approved.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was a lot more work. I felt like the city was helping us along in the process, but it was definitely more work than we were used to, and it was a bit taxing on the volunteers, who of course were doing all this additional work on top of their regular schedules.
Just to wrap it up, for people who might have missed the festival this year, any words of advice or wisdom to impart on them for next year?
Yeah, thanks for coming out. Thanks for being supportive. Thanks for being patient. And if anybody has any comments, suggestions, concerns, appreciations, please send us your feedback on our website at carfreevancouver.org. We would love to have you all join our organizing teams. We're all just locals. None of us are necessarily event planners by trade. So if anybody has wants to see a block party in their neck of the woods, if anybody wants to join one of our current organizing teams, we would love to have you. We're totally volunteer, and we'd love to have you out.
Awesome. Great. So thank you to Maddie Kipling for that interview about Car Free Vancouver. And now it's time for our international news. So for international headlines and more, we go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. The Supreme Court released four decisions today. In Salazar v. Rama Navajo chapter, justices said the federal government must fully reimburse the tribe for money spent when they take over a federal program, even if the bill exceeds spending limits set by Congress. In a case about land use, the court ruled that a Michigan landowner can sue the government in an effort to block a tribe's casino development. On labor, the court said that pharmaceutical sales reps don't qualify for overtime pay. And the court let stand the rape conviction of a man who claimed his right to face his accusers was violated when one DNA analyst testified about a co-worker's tests. All of Japan's nuclear power plants have been shuttered since early May, but that's likely to change soon when the plant that serves the country's second largest metropolis, Osaka, is restarted. Claudia Craig reports.
Japan's PM Yoshihiko Noda announced Saturday that the Ohi nuclear power plant is set to resume operations. Osaka's mayor has given his approval, as has the governor of the Fukui Prefecture. Noda cited the economic hit Japan took from the shutdown, the increased cost of non-nuclear fuel, and the effect on the livelihood of the many thousands in the industry. The Ohi plant is operated by the Kansai Electric Power Company, or KEPCO, who, like the operators of the doomed Fukushima plant, TEPCO, or Tokyo Electric Power Company, has a less than perfect record of safety and plant integrity. both citizen activists who staged a die-in in front of the Prime Minister's office, as well as the tens of thousands of Fukushima evacuees who still don't know when or if they can return home, are alarmed and cite safety concerns. Eileen Miyoko-Smith is with Green Action Japan.
People that have been damaged by the Fukushima accident, they are really angry. They cannot understand why the government would do this. And these are just, you know, normal folks that have been, their lives have been wrecked.
KEPCO officials say it will take about 3 weeks for the first Ohi reactor to go back online and will be followed by Ohi's number four. Claudia Craig, FSRN.
The United Nations Human Rights Chief, Navi Pillay, said today that violence and human rights violations in Syria may amount to crimes against humanity. Over the weekend, the UN called off its monitoring mission, saying both sides are asserting their military positions. Mission leader General Robert Mood.
Innocent civilians, men, women, and children are being killed every day. It also poses a significant risk to my unarmed observers.
General Mood called on both sides to allow civilians to evacuate conflict areas, saying the UN would monitor the process. According to the local coordination committees, dozens died in Douma today. 80 tanks entered Tafas. World leaders are in Mexico's peninsular resort Los Cabos for a G20 summit. But over the weekend, far from the spotlight, a wave of violence targeted indigenous rights activists in southern Mexico. Shannon Young reports.
Two indigenous rights defenders were murdered and another two activists sustained non-fatal gunshot wounds in three separate incidents this weekend in Oaxaca. The body of Sergio Garcia Vasquez, an attorney with a state-run office for indigenous public defenders, was left along a highway in the Mixteca region. He had been missing for 18 days and was evidently tortured before being shot execution style in the back of the head. In the Sierra Norte region, Severiano Hernandez Mendez, a longtime indigenous activist and founder of an organization of Zapotec and Chinantec communities in the state's resource-rich northern mountains, was murdered in his home. And in San Jose del Progreso, two brothers, both anti-mine activists, were hospitalized after two men allegedly associated with the pro-mining camp shot them in the center of town. So far this year, two opponents of the Canadian-owned silver and gold mine in San Jose have been killed and five have been wounded by gunfire. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
For the second Sunday running, suicide bombers attacked churches in northern Nigeria during services, sparking retaliatory attacks on Muslims. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
As many as 50 people died. The victims include both worshippers in three separate church bombings in the northern state of Kaduna and Muslims killed by angry Christians in response. No group has claimed responsibility for the bombing of the churches, but the Islamist militant group Boko Haram, which is fighting for the introduction of Islamic law in Nigeria, has in the past claimed responsibility for similar attacks. Hundreds of people have been killed in church bombings since January. Reprisal attacks are growing more frequent as the government has not been able to stop the bombings. Sam Lukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Rodney King, the man whose 1991 videotaped beating by police sparked deadly riots the next year when the officers were acquitted, has died of an apparent drowning. During the unrest, Mr. King called for peace.
I just want to say, you know, Can we all get along? Can we get along? Can we stop making it horrible for the older people and the kids?
Rodney King was 47. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Voters also went to polls in Greece over the weekend for the second time in less than 2 months. The vote comes in the midst of a persistent economic, political, and social crisis in the country. The conservative New Democracy Party has emerged as the front runner with nearly 30% of the vote, closely followed by the far-left coalition, Syriza, with nearly 27%. The results likely mean the country won't leave the euro, but conservatives will first need to form an alliance with another party, and they could align with the PASOK, or Socialist Party, that came in third, with about 12% of the vote. From Athens, FSRN's Aris Economou reports.
Sunday's poll failed to give a majority to any of the seven parties elected in parliament, and a coalition must be formed. But that might not be so easy to accomplish. Alexis Tsipras, president of Syriza party, says they won't participate in a coalition with the conservative New Democracy Party that supports a Eurozone bailout and austerity measures. His far-left party appealed to voters struggling with job and wage cuts. Yorgos Maltesos, a student and first-time voter of Syriza, says he feels trapped by the election result.
Syriza was my last solution. In the first round of elections, the Syriza party strongly criticized the Communist Party for not wanting to participate in a left government coalition they had proposed. It even blamed it for sabotaging the only solution for saving Greece and the people. However, today, Syriza, thanks to its exploding score, has 10% more than in the 6th of May election. It can make an effort to create such a government or at least try to improve our life, and it refuses. What is there to hope if even the left wing does not keep its promises?
Other voters also expressed despair. But for unemployed cashier Nicoleta Vasilaki, she's concerned about the rising popularity of the extreme right Golden Dawn Party.
It is incredible that there are more than 400,000 people that voted for the neo-Nazi party. After all, our parents and grandparents lived during the Second World War and the 70s military junta. I understand the desperation that results from unemployment and poverty. I have been unemployed for 6 months with no unemployment benefits. But the Golden Dawn is a violent party that organizes attacks on immigrants. It is openly anti-Semitic, racist, and pro-Nazi. There is nothing to expect from them apart from hatred.
The Golden Dawn Party will keep 18 seats in parliament. It also opposes the bailout and appeal to some voters through its anti-immigrant rhetoric. Key EU leaders want to see a coalition government formed as fast as possible to avoid further impacts on the European market. They are also urging the political leaders to move forward with austerity measures. But for Panayotis Karanikos, a construction worker in Athens, the EU reforms only exploit Greece's workers.
I do not trust the EU. They have destroyed our country's agriculture, our social and labor rights, and now they are putting pressure to make us pay a debt that they pushed to create. The EU, and I mean the leaders of the central countries and the interests they represent, just want to make Greeks poor by applying austerity packages.
Under the Greek constitution, political leaders have 3 days to propose a coalition government. With the radical left Syriza party refusing to join the pro-bailout conservatives, the New Democracy Party could align with the election's third-place winner, the Socialist Party, PASOK, which also supports the bailout. Aris Economou, FSRN, in Athens.
Thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that's our program for today, Monday, June 18th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to get involved or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. Today's show is produced by Nina, and from the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned now for Sore Throats Clapping Hands right here on CITR 101.9 FM.